It's a 5-year-old's dream to be able to do the work that I get to do. I go out and catch frogs and toads and salamanders.
Welcome to Viewscapes, stories from Washington State Magazine, connecting you to Washington State University, the state, and the world. Hi, I'm Larry Clark, editor of the magazine. In this episode, we'll search for the Western Toad, listen to memories from World War II Dutch resistance fighter Carla Pepperzak, and delve into the powerful, moving novel Stripland with author Joan Burbick.
Almost fell in.
Areem Gomez is at the Snake River, searching for the Western Toad. Areem is a doctoral student in natural resource sciences. He worked with associate professor Rodney Saylor in the WSU Endangered Species Lab, where he conducted the first comprehensive survey of frogs and salamanders on the Palouse Prairie since the 1930s. Though it is estimated that only 2 or 3% of native Palouse Prairie remains, he was pleasantly surprised to find a healthy biodiversity of amphibians. A large part of Areem's research involves developing wetland conservation plans specifically tailored to protect the different types of Palouse amphibians.
As a kid, I used to go out and catch frogs and toads and salamanders. And now as an adult, I go out and catch frogs and toads and salamanders. 5-year-old me would be really happy with myself. It's a 5-year-old's dream to be able to do the work that I get to do.
We're at Wawawi Park, down by the Snake River. We're on a little inlet here. We have bullfrogs and western toads here before, so hopefully we find some today. One of the things that's different about these toads compared to other toads is that they're pretty aquatic toads. You'll see them floating in the water versus other toads, you won't see that. What I want to do is walk down toward there and see if I can find any. So I'm going to get closer to the wetland here, walk through some blackberry patch. Hopefully I don't get scratched up. And also see if I... Oh, you hear that chirp? That's a western toad chirp. So you'll find bullfrogs along, they're pretty common along the Snake River. They do well with other invasive species, so they can coexist with the bass that have been introduced and the carp that have been introduced into the area.
I've been really successful catching amphibian larvae using these small mesh minnow traps. I put an empty water bottle in them so the minnow trap floats.
So one of the things that I look for when I'm looking for individuals is looking for those eyes that I see. So if you look there, you have a patch of algae and you see these two big eyes sticking out of the water. It's in that middle patch of algae, halfway out, about 3/4 of a meter out into the algae. And what'll probably happen as soon as it is, if this is a western toad, it would probably just stay there, but since it's a bullfrog, as I approach, it's probably just gonna jump under the water. And there he goes, jumping across.
Working with amphibians is like working for the little guy. People don't have strong emotions about amphibians one way or the other. It's not like other creatures that have political and economic issues. But what I have found is when I've talked to landowners, they're more than happy to try to do things and improve wetland habitat if they know what to do. I found out that no one had done extensive surveying of Palouse Prairie amphibians, at least on the Washington side. So to be able to come in and do basic ecology work was really fun and exciting to do. Amphibians are the most endangered vertebrate group. The reason for this is because they both depend on land and aquatic ecosystems. They start their life on aquatic ecosystems and often move to a terrestrial form. And if one of those ecosystems isn't healthy, it'll disrupt their life stage and the populations can become threatened.
A lot of people in hiding were betrayed, and so I was lucky that nobody was betrayed from the people I knew.
That's Carla Pepperzak. Carla is a 96-year-old Jewish woman living in Spokane. She's originally from the Netherlands. And 80 years ago, when she was a 16-year-old living in Amsterdam, the Nazis invaded and occupied her homeland. That changed everything for Jews, who are now the focus of intense persecution.
I started out helping people to go into hiding and followed it up by having them, you know, rationing cards and sometimes medication, and always visit them about once a month. And did that actually during all the time they were in hiding. And
she did all this in secret, hiding the fact that she herself was a Jew. By Nazi decree, her movements were strictly prescribed. The Nazis issued ID cards, and the ones given to Jews were stamped with a J. Jews, including Carla, also had to wear the infamous yellow star in public. Carla's father worked with an attorney who produced ID cards. He was able to secure an identity card for Carla without a J.
So once I did not have the J on my ID card, I could take off the star and I could do things that other Jewish people were not allowed to do anymore, like taking a streetcar or a train or a bus or being in certain stores, and I had quite a bit more freedom, and so that's how I could start helping other people.
One day, Carla learned that her aunt, along with her 5 cousins, were being deported.
I donned my German nurse's uniform, which I had bought. I worked, because of my training, had to work in hospitals and laboratories, and I could purchase a German nurse's uniform. I put that on and went to the railroad station. I found her and the family in the train.
Carla was only able to save one, her 2.5-year-old cousin.
And I took him with me. And I was stopped, but I spoke fluent German, and I explained to the Nazis who stopped me that I was, his mother, and that he was ill, that I had to get him out to a hospital, and they let me go. And so I was very fortunate.
Not only was Carla smart, she was young and she was pretty. And she'd use those attributes to keep herself and the people she was helping out of the hands of the Nazis. It was a survival tactic.
Absolutely. Several times when I was being interrogated, you would say, I did smile at them, and I did, and I'm normally not a flirt, but I did flirt with them, and I'm convinced that that helped me a great deal.
Carla was part of the Dutch Resistance, an underground network working against the Nazi regime. Shipments came from England. After sending encoded coordinates to resistance members, small boats and planes made deliveries of all kinds of things, including the means for Carla to falsify ID cards.
And I got those cards, and I got they gave me a little machine to make the thumbprint, also the frame which goes around the picture, and so I got those too. And I learned how to make false IDs, and I made about 100. I became pretty good at it, so that's. I kept them in a little suitcase. I was being interrogated by 2 Nazi officers who came to the house, and again I passed the test because, like I said, I flirted with them and answered the questions, I guess, correctly. Anyhow, they left. And when they had left, I had to leave too, and I had my little suitcase with a little machine and the carts in there. And one of them said, when I was carried, my mom was being very polite. He said, "Let me carry it for you." Like I said, it was if they had looked inside or the suitcase had fallen open, I wouldn't be sitting here.
Maybe Carla did have, as she says, a bit of luck. But what courage too. I'm Adriana Janovich for Viewscapes.
I learned a tremendous amount through writing the fiction, which is odd, an odd way to...
So what did you learn?
Oh, I learned that reality is not what we perceive it to be. Reality is always invaded by other perceptions.
That's Joan Burbick. For many years, Burbick was an English professor at Washington State University. A few years ago, she retired and she said to herself, "No more excuses," and out poured a novel, Stripland. Stripland is set on 21st Street in Lewiston, Idaho. This wide boulevard is steep, and both sides are thick with strip malls and big box stores. Burbick's finely realized characters wander through this landscape as they deal with the aftermath of the shooting death of a Nez Perce man by a white cop.
I was able to spend some time with one of the Nez Perce elders, who is now deceased, and the shooting happened on his property. And so he and his wife were very, very gracious and in allowing me into their home and talking with me, usually about other things besides the shooting. The shooting happened rather late in my spending time with them. And it just brought home to me how this violence lingers. And these acts of violence cannot be taken away. They are there, and they are like almost like permanent stains on the people who are left behind.
Yeah.
They have to understand this, and they often don't understand why these things happen. I thought about writing about this shooting as nonfiction, mm-hmm. and I spent some time kind of going over that, and I realized that the story I wanted to tell was so much more about the place and the people than nonfiction was going to get at. Nonfiction was going to have a way of progressing that never got under the skin of the characters and let them speak for themselves. I mean, there of course there are techniques where you can do that, but never in a highly imaginative way, which I felt this topic needed. It needed the freedom to follow out these characters.
Burbick is in fact the author of several works of nonfiction, including a 2006 book called Gun Show Nation.
So when I was working on the gun book, I realized that people were talking to me about guns as if they were talking about fantasies about guns.
Interesting.
And so, you know, how do you come to terms with that? You know, if you listen to people, they often move away from realism into dream or even interesting lies.
Right.
So I think that's what fiction can get at.
Yeah.
If you allow it to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess I don't want to fall into the trap of talking about conflict for its own sake, because certainly working on the gun book, I saw that talking about guns invited immediate conflict. And in fact, the conflict was the fun. The conflict was the trap. You know, it was almost like a ritual. That was how you did good radio. That's how you could do good TV.
Right.
You know, that was the game.
But back to 21st Street, back to Stripland. Just beyond all the boxy, blown trash clutter of capitalism are the dry, rifted hillsides, thick with brush. This hidden world is where the homeless, the disenfranchised, and the grief-addled wait out the bright hours before reinventing the reality of Stripland at night. There's the man with a heavy rope tied around his waist, as if he needed a grounding wire or an anchor to keep him tethered to the earth. And then there's the lawyer of impossible cases, who is trying to find the man with the rope before the cops do. And then there's a pair of tween-age girls who, together with their wise and pragmatic Nez Perce aunties, become the heroes of Stripland.
I think there are like millions of these stories in the United States.
Yes.
And how that's going to affect neighborhoods and families, loved ones, people who are indifferent or angry. I mean, it's just there. It's in the community.
Yeah.
So I think that made me really want to write this book as best I could.
This story that Burbick guides us through is very real, but it shifts and rifts through dimensions beyond the standard four, dimensions perhaps spiritual, perhaps haunted, and definitely connected via ecosystems that defy science and demand the music of poetry for description. Here in Stripland, the power of spirit is a kind of physical force that sometimes shoves people around rudely or launches them into grace. Here in Stripland, to be haunted is a gift, a reminder of the ways we are all interconnected, both through tragedy, but also through love. I'm Brian Clark.
Thanks for listening to Viewscapes, a monthly podcast from Washington State Magazine. Our theme music was written by Greg Yasinitsky. For more WSU stories, videos, and photos, visit magazine.wsu.edu.